Good morning. I thought to lead a short meditation this morning as part of our generation of the virtuous motivation to engage in this weekend's activity of discussing the Dhamma. So this is a meditation that I led earlier on my visit, of developing our mind, generating our mind in the attitude of warmth and loving kindness towards others by first thinking of those close to us in our lives, particularly mother, father and so on, and trying to generate our mind in the aspect of appreciation of their kindness and love, and imagining that as light in our body, and then sending it to all other beings. So we'll do that meditation together. Begin by first checking your physical posture. Make sure you feel comfortable, your back straight. Rest your right hand and your left, thumbs together, hands in your lap, elbows loose, head slightly angled forward. Breathing normally through your nose and your eyes either slightly open or very lightly closed. Focus your whole attention on the sensation of the air entering and leaving the nostrils with each breath, and try to gain mindfulness, uninterrupted focus of attention upon the breath, not allowing your mind to be distracted by thoughts of anything else. Now imagine that your mother is meditating beside you to your left side, and imagine her appearing young and healthy as she was when you were born. And then think of the kindness that she showed towards you when you were still in her womb and after you were born. How your safety and welfare was at the top of her mind She cared for you with great tenderness, feeding you, cleaning you, dressing you, teaching you how to walk, to talk, and so on. Reflect upon the kindness, which you can't remember now, but you can infer the depth of love that she had towards you when you were a baby. As you think of your mother's kindness, feel in your mind the growing energy of a wish of how wonderful it would be if I could repay her kindness. And with that thought, at your heart, your whole mind takes the aspect of warm love towards your mother. Imagine that energy of love appears as warm, blissful, healing light that arises continually from your heart, and this energy spreads throughout your body, totally eliminating all physical and mental problems that you may be experiencing. Then imagine that from your heart you send a stream of this blissful light, this healing energy from your heart to your mother's heart, and her body and mind too are completely filled with this blissful healing energy that removes all physical and mental problems of wherever she is now, still in this life or in her future life. Your heart-to-heart communication with your mother completely brings peace and happiness to her mind, resolves all of her problems. Really feel this is actually happening. Now imagine your father meditating to your right, appearing young and healthy as he was when you were born. Think of all that he has done for you in your life since you were born, looking after you and so on. And in a similar way, generate the wish to repay his kindness and send a stream of the blissful, healing nectar of love from your heart to his heart. So wherever he is now, you have heart-to-heart communication. And all of his physical and mental problems are eliminated by the blissful nectar of love. And now imagine the remainder of your family and friends all meditating behind you and thinking of each one in turn, remembering their kindness. Send to each one a ray of blissful, healing light of love from your heart to their hearts as before. And now imagine that meditating in front of you and facing you are any beings for whom you feel dislike or even anger. Those who have caused immediate harm to yourself or your family and friends, or even historical figures from the past or political figures in the present who you dislike, and see them as being victims of their own ignorance, self-centeredness and anger. Their minds as being very miserable in their hostility. But in the past, they've been loving and kind to you and to their own families, to all beings. See them as not different from your family and friends. and with genuine compassion for their suffering, send the blissful, healing energy of love from your heart to their, from your heart to their hearts as well. All their mental and physical problems are eliminated. And now imagine all remaining universal sentient beings in the aspect of humans meditating in circles all around you and extending out to the horizon and seeing them all as your universal family at different times have all been each other's mother, father, brother, sister, husband, wife. Send out wave after wave of the blissful healing energy of love from your heart, imagining that you touch the hearts of every sentient being throughout the universe. Their environments become pure lands, and their minds are totally cleansed of all suffering and its causes, and they all achieve enlightenment. Then, having completed its purpose, the blissful energy of universal love that had radiated from your body returns, completely filling you with great bliss. And all the beings and their pure environments dissolve into the Dharmakaya, omniscient mind of Buddhahood. So you remain like a bubble of blissful energy floating in clear empty space. The outline of your body is there, but internally your body is hollow and completely filled with a blissful white light of universal love. then imagine that all appearance of your body and mind fades away into emptiness from the outside in. The last point to go is at your heart. And your mind, still in the aspect of bliss, experiences your ultimate nature of emptiness of inherent existence. Appearing to your awareness like clear, empty space. Then within that empty space, your mind generates the attitude of bodhicitta, the determination to release and guide all other sentient beings out of suffering. And that energy of bodhicitta appears as blissful light within this space of like emptiness. And that light takes the shape of your old body. With your mind inside. But think that the old body of and mind of that arose from karma and disturbing emotions has gone forever. And now your body and mind are the products of wisdom and compassion. Appearing like this, with the sole purpose and meaning of guiding others out of samsara and into the bliss of liberation and enlightenment. The thought that this is the purpose of your existence, which you shall never forget from now until you attain enlightenment, then you can gradually relax and stop the meditation. So now we're going to discuss the very first teaching given by the Buddha, which was the summary of all he had to say. And for the next 40 years, he expanded the fundamental teaching of the Four Noble Truths in so many details, but everything was just an elaboration of this first teaching. As in the meditation, we generated the attitude of determination to guide all sentient beings out of suffering. Now we have to face reality that we can't stop our own suffering. And we have to do that in order to be capable of guiding others. But it is possible. As Buddha, in teaching the Four Noble Truths, he presented to us the two sets of cause and effect. The first set is the true suffering and the true cause of suffering. So, as we do have obstacles, so many difficulties in training our mind in Dharma, as they have a recognizable cause, which is in our own mind, then we have the opportunity with that knowledge to prevent those causes and to eliminate past causes, and in doing so, eliminate true suffering. So that's the first set of cause and effect, the first truth and the second. The third and fourth noble truths, true cessation of suffering and its causes, and the true path which leads to that cessation, shows us the method by which we achieve the elimination of suffering and its causes. The method followed by Shakyamuni Buddha and every Buddha of the past and the future will follow exactly the same path. Very clearly, it is explained, and in our discussion in this weekend, we begin with discussing the first truth, the truth of suffering, because although we might agree that we've got some problems in our life, we actually have more problems than we think we have. They're much more subtle or deeply rooted in our lives. And even what we think are not problems, our enjoyment, our happiness, the things we equally in society strive to achieve, sensory pleasure, mental pleasure, there is difficulty and problems associated with even our ordinary happiness. Not that happiness and pleasure themselves are problems, but our attachment to those experiences, our desire to have those experiences and to have them again, and so on, that is the problem. So that is what we have to really understand, and what the first teaching of Buddha explains, the nature of suffering and its cause. I've been reflecting. In general, when people hear the Buddha's teachings, that's fairly true in my experience. Yes, my crazy mind is indeed a big problem. But can these teachings be really true? True. Where did mind begin? Where will it end? Where are we coming from? Where are we going? Buddha said, don't bother with those questions. there are answers. But if we put off practicing Dharma, putting the teaching into practice, because we're not quite sure, well, what about, we want to intellectually know, where did it come from? Where are we going? Then impermanence and death will intervene before we seriously get down to doing what we can do, working with our mind and changing our mind. Whilst we are still alive, whilst we have this opportunity, whilst the big problems in life, you know, aging, where we lose the strength of our body, where we lose our mental capacity to be able to gain concentration, to understand the teachings, when serious sickness comes, when our body and mind are just not able to think about, study and practice Dharma. So before those things happen, which can happen at any time, and death can happen at any time, we have to get down to it. We have to put the teachings into action and don't procrastinate. So Buddha taught true suffering first. Now that's the result. And the cause of that result, the true origins or the true sources, we taught that second. But if we don't really recognize the dangerous situation we are experiencing, that we have now, we won't be moved strongly enough to do something about it. We'll easily become more complacent and swept up in the affairs of this life. Now, of course, we do have responsibility to look after our family, our friends, to play a role in society. A responsibility, as we did in the meditation, you know, it's more than just our family and friends, even the people we dislike, even all the others who we don't know at all. We do have a degree of responsibility. And it is the very power of having a sense of universal responsibility. It's huge, isn't it? Like we might want to just take a holiday, but no, the kids have to go to school, we have to pay their school fees, and my parents are getting old, we have to make sure that they're okay, they get the best medical treatment, that they're looked after. So that energizes us to not slacken off and take holidays. And we do work hard for the immediate family and friends who depend upon us. That gives us energy to really work hard in life to look after those who depend upon us. To achieve enlightenment, achieve our potential of Buddhahood, requires a great deal of energy, a great deal of effort in overcoming the obstacles on the path. And we're going to learn about the path. So how do we get the energy to overcome those gross and subtle obstacles in our minds and in the outside world to achieving enlightenment? Universal responsibility. Responsibility not just for mother, father, family, friends, but for all sentient beings. And if we, so bodhicitta, it's not an intellectual thought of how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were free from suffering. But it is the determination that I will be the one, that it's my personal responsibility to guide them towards enlightenment. And so that responsibility that we take upon ourselves, that is what gives us the energy to achieve the path to enlightenment. There is no other source of energy. Like, you know, you've heard the teachings of the precious human rebirth, where at last, after so many eons of rebirth in the lower realms, we're born human, this rare opportunity to be born human. And on top of that, we've had the incredible karma to meet with the teachings, and we have the leisure to be able to listen and practice the teachings, put them into practice. So in the Lamrim, the Graduated Path teachings, it says that the perfect human rebirth is like a rocket ship that can travel throughout the universe. A rocket ship that can travel to enlightenment. But a rocket ship has to have fuel. So our perfect human rebirth is not enough. We need the fuel of bodhicitta, this sense of universal responsibility and the determination that I will release all mother's innate beings from suffering. So that is the fuel which will take our rocket ship to our enlightenment. If we think, oh look, there's plenty of other Buddhas and they've all got bodhicitta, so I'll do what I can, but they can look after the ones who are living on the other side of the universe. I'll just look after the ones on this earth. That, just that thought, will, it will prevent bodhicitta from arising and will be no fuel to follow the path to enlightenment. Even excluding one person, one sentient being, that one, I don't like him or her. They can suffer in hell. They've been so cruel to me and to others. Let them be punished for their harmful action. That thought, which excludes just one person from our determination to guide all from suffering, that stops bodhicitta. That eliminates bodhicitta. So you see, in our meditation, we generated universal loving kindness and bodhicitta, sending out the light, leading all sentient beings to enlightenment, and imagining them, you know, dissolving into the Dharmakaya. And then we dissolved into emptiness. And within emptiness, the wisdom realizing emptiness, our bodhicitta manifested as the light which took the shape of our body, so that our old body was gone. But even though we might look the same, in fact, now our bodies are not the product of karma and afflictions, they're the product of wisdom and compassion. So if we had excluded just one sentient being from our love and compassion, then that whole meditation goes out the window. It wouldn't work. So we have to continually train our mind in bodhicitta. It's not going to come overnight, but it is possible to generate bodhicitta in this life. Difficult to understand emptiness. Yeah. The intellectual presentation of emptiness is quite complicated. And it's hard to see the point. Why do our teachers put so much emphasis on emptiness? But bodhicitta, we can easily understand the suffering of others. How? By understanding our own suffering, because we're all equal, and whatever problems we have are the same as problems experienced by others, and in fact others experiencing even greater problems than we experience. When things go wrong for us, we become incredibly energized to get rid of our problems. Just me, number one. So, if we embrace all others in our mental attitude, how much energy will we have then when we see the sufferings of others? So, there are many illustrations in history, in Buddhism, and maybe perhaps in you know, the great saints of other religions, the great practitioners, could well be that there is the similar attitude of universal love and kindness which enables individuals to overcome huge obstacles to help others. So we, in this weekend, through discussing the four fundamental truths, the Arya truths or noble truths of Buddha, this is the method by recognizing the depth and extent of suffering in our own minds, in the minds of those close to us, in the minds of others in society, that we can definitely grow, mature our mind away from self-centered responsibility to a sense of responsibility for all others. So, the first topic, in those who have the notes, we have them from online or the printed notes, there is the reflection on the six general problems or sufferings of living in samsara, or living in lives under the control of karma and disturbing emotions. So these general problems or general faults are experienced by us all. And the first is the fault of uncertainty. We desire happiness in our life. Look at our own life. We want happiness. Where do we look for happiness? In our family and friends, in our possessions, in our social achievements and so on, social recognition. But nothing is certain in the goals that we wish to achieve in our life to be happy. That's our fundamental purpose, to be happy. Friends, we're certain, yes, the bigger my circle of friends, then the happier I will be. But it's not definite. Even people who've been friends for a long time can fall out. We know that from our own experience. Good, strong friends from the past have distanced themselves from us. They may even have become our enemies. A friend become our worst enemy. I remember once when I was in Mongolia, and our resident teacher, very lovely Lama Geshe, and we used to always have meals together, the people at the center, and he used to use a lot of salt, too much salt, which from my side was, as a doctor, not good. And I said, Genla, there's a bit too much salt on your plate. Salt and I are good friends. I said, Genla, the Lamrim says that even your best friend can become your worst enemy. He acknowledged the scriptural quotation. But it does happen. We depend upon people to be our friends and there when we need them. Sometimes it doesn't happen. This is a reality. Even our husband or wife, who we once saw as the most beautiful, perfect person in the world, and this is my soulmate, I can be so happy if I make this person my husband, my wife, if we live together. That's how it begins, but hopefully not in our experience, but we can see in the experience of others, that the soulmate becomes our worst enemy. In Australian society, domestic violence is the most common cause of injury and death. So many murders occur as a result of domestic violence, more than from any other cause. So not only can our friends become our enemies, but our enemies can become our friends. Lots of situations where people who have hated, didn't want to know about, conditions change and they become close friends. So that's the first thing to reflect upon, uncertainty. There is no rock solid guarantee that the people or the objects or the social status that we depend upon for happiness and peace of mind will remain stable. It's always changing, and changing in both ways. Enemies become friends, friends become enemies. So the happiness, just happiness itself, happy situation, whether it's a holiday or whatever, brings about, it can't last. It's got to change. In the evenings, or afternoons, I like to go for a walk up the road to the Kallang Park by the river. And I was sitting on the bench, just peaceful park, and there was the instruments for exercising. People who are jogging, then you can, you know, do the walking exercise and the chin-ups and whatever. And there was a mother with her little girl, I don't know, 3 years old. And they'd been walking, so they sat there for a while, and the little girl was having such fun on these machines. And somebody else is there with their very friendly little dog. So the little girl's really enjoying going playing. Then mum got up and said, "Come on, we have to go." Suddenly, total change in the little girl, from happiness to no. And the mum's walking away, and the little girl refused to go away. She's pointing back at the things she'd been enjoying and the dong. And it took a fight until eventually mum had to come back and pick up her daughter and carry her away with much screaming and crying. So we know this situation, and we understand what's happening in the children's minds. But as adults, how often are we reduced to tears and despair, not wanting to separate from a happy situation, but we have no choice? No choice. Our own body will age, you'll get sick, it'll die. Our relationships can't last forever. Even if our life has been happy right through, still it will come to an end. Our wealth, our accumulation of money and possessions and so on, in order to be happy, can't last. It's easily lost. So many, even our body and our friendships are still intact, we lose the wealth, the material objects that we thought would always be there to protect us, to ensure that we're happy. It's happening again and again in our lives, in the lives of those around us. There's no stability in life. As much as we want it to remain the same as the little girl being taken away by her mum from a playground, that's constantly happening in ordinary life. So, attachment to pleasure and aversion and hostility and anger towards situations which cause suffering or lead to displeasure are meaningless. There's no point in being totally caught up in ambition to achieve a certain situation in life that's going to make me happy. There's no point in being very angry and upset at people or things which intrude upon my happiness or threaten to prevent my happiness. And so often, you know, our attachment, our anger, they dominate our thoughts. And they even prevent happiness from happening. You know, at work, we experience problems with our boss or with the people we work with, and there's arguments. And so it's real disaster. We come home from work, we're unhappy, we can't stop thinking about what happened there. And even if our family is loving and friendly, they can't make us happy because we're so caught up in hostility. So it's meaningless. You know, living our lives, pursuing things out of attachment or just eating our heart out with anger and aggression have no meaning. And if we're honest and we look at all our plans of what we're going to do with our life, what we're going to achieve, what we're going to avoid, that actually dominates the activities in our life. We fall down, we lose something, we want to rebuild it. Again and again, we try to recreate what we're convinced will bring peace and happiness, but it doesn't work. It doesn't mean we shouldn't ensure that we have the material necessities for, you know, protection and for full belly and health and so on. It doesn't mean that we should not actively oppose antagonistic, harmful people and harmful attitudes. But we don't do it with desire or attachment and anger. We deal with them in a sensible, intelligent way. And what we should mainly do, instead of our life being totally attachment and aversion, our whole life should be directed towards cultivating Dharma, practicing Dharma. Our goal in life should be liberation and enlightenment. And then we will use whatever happens in life, whether we're happy, whether we're unhappy, we will use that situation on our path to enlightenment. As those who are here on Wednesday night, we discussed, this is the Bodhisattva's practice, transforming both problems and happiness into the path to enlightenment. So, in that way, nothing is wasted. Everything, good or bad, is an opportunity. Whilst we have this perfect human rebirth, to direct it towards our potential of enlightenment. That's the only sensible thing. That's the only sensible attitude in life. Everybody else is just worried about their reputation, their status, their circle of friends, their accumulation of wealth, the type of car they drive, the house where they live in, the clothes they wear, the entertainments that they're able to see, the holidays that they're able to afford to go to. You know, those things are meaningless, and there is no guarantee that they'll bring happiness. So uncertainty is the first universal problem in samsara. There are five more. The second is dissatisfaction. So uncertainty really applies to everything, the external world. Dissatisfaction is in here, in our own mind, right? When we do achieve our goals, we experience peace and happiness. It's not enough. We're not content. Dissatisfaction drives us to seek more, greater variety. We thought this person was the person for my life. We marry this person, we live the person, but we become dissatisfied with each other. Somebody else appears. Oh yes, that is the one for me. So we reject one friend or one partner, causing so much pain to ourselves and to others. Maybe our own pain comes later. How often have we abandoned one friend or one partner to go off with somebody else? That didn't work out. How often have we regretted abandoning the what person we were with? Then our pain sinks in, but their pain came from our rejection. And so that past peace and happiness is gone. It can't ever be recreated. Our crazy mind thinks, yes, I can recreate past happiness, but the world has moved on. We can't recreate those peaceful times of the past. And they weren't as peaceful as we think they were. Otherwise, we would never have rejected the situation. So dissatisfaction. You know, wealth, the more wealth we accumulate, the more we want. We go from one house to a better house to a better house, one job to a better job, in our mind, better. But it doesn't work. In the Lam Rim, it says that we've drunk more milk from the breasts of our mothers, and we've cried more tears than all of the oceans. In our past lives, we've wasted our bodies for these senseless or meaningless desires, which have been insatiable. This dissatisfaction, this constant desire for more and different, etc., is a major internal fault. The previous fault, uncertainty, mainly covers the external objects for our pleasure. Then the internal fault, personal fault, is the internal dissatisfaction. So again, instead of following this constant urge for something different, for something better, for more and more, we change our mind towards liberation. The whole goal, the whole purpose of our life is liberation. And from the Bodhisattva's point of view, releasing all beings from suffering. So as we're in our meditation, we generated the bodhicitta. That bodhicitta appeared in this aspect of our body. And so at the end of that meditation, having gone into emptiness and within emptiness generated great compassion, that is the purpose for your life. You know, I said you appear in your old body, but it's no longer your old body. It's no longer coming from karma and afflictions. It's coming from wisdom and bodhicitta. So we conclude that meditation, the purpose of my life is to guide all, to achieve enlightenment, to guide all sentient beings from suffering. So instead of following dissatisfaction, and whenever dissatisfaction arises, and it does constantly because we are addicted to pleasure and we are addicted to the desire for more and more pleasure, when that appears in our mind, do you really have to go and buy that new car? What's wrong with your old car? Well, I heard in Singapore, 10 years old, you have to get rid of it. Is that right? That's terrible. Well, my car in Australia is 30 years old. It's fantastic. You know, it'll still be going when I'm gone. Anyway. Thinking of the dissatisfaction, recognize the thing, it's not the thing, it's recognizing the dissatisfaction in our mind. Then we say, step aside. I've always followed you. I'm not, my life, I just need the basic things. I have all this potential to direct my life towards enlightenment, to guiding all sentient beings out of suffering. So, dissatisfaction. It's there, it's in our mind. We have to recognize it when it manifests. The third point is that we repeatedly have to give up our lives and our bodies, like again and again. No matter how attractive our body is, how much energy we put into exercising and eating the right foods, avoiding the wrong foods, into taking medicines, and so on. How much plastic surgery we have to change the appearance of our body. All of this is ridiculous. This body is going to let us down. We're going to suffer. We're going to die. The body will age. It will be awful. And we have to go on to a future body. And this has happened countless times in the past. We have had much more attractive bodies in past lives than we've got now. But it's gone. They became agents of suffering. There's a really sad thing. In Australia recently I saw, there's a woman, she had incredibly attractive, she'd been a model, and she was getting on, she's 45 or 50 years old, but still incredibly attractive. But she thought, oh, not enough. Maybe if I just get some of that skin filler, you know, they inject the, whatever they inject, just to make her forehead a little more attractive, that'd be nice. So, they put in some stuff which wasn't the right stuff. And there's a photo of, and it was unbelievable. I mean, it caused the skin to grow and swell. And apparently when her doctor saw it, the doctor burst into tears. And there's this a monster, she's turned into a monster, where the skin all grew down over her. She became blind in one eye. And like her face became a terrifying monster. Despite further and further surgery, nothing could be done. So it's such a sad story. This very conventionally attractive woman who did not need to have a rounded forehead. But no, not quite right. I just want to look a bit more. Really sad. So much suffering. So, these bodies, which we try to look after, because the body, of course, is the agent of our pleasure, then not only do we have to abandon them, but we have to be reborn in ugly situations. In future life, in this life, it can become ugly. In the future life, there's no guarantee it'll be human. Instead of nice, smooth, attractive skin, we could be covered in fur or feathers or scales, you know. We can be completely different. And it has happened in the past and it can happen in the future. So the again, investing so much of our energy and life into our appearance and our bodies. Yes, of course, we have to look after our bodies. We should make sure they're healthy and fit and free from sickness. But don't become obsessed with that. Use this body and mind to practice Dharma, to follow the path to liberation and enlightenment, to be totally free from that. So that's the third problem. Well, the third reality that we have to repeatedly, through karma and afflictions, our body is changing, we repeatedly take attractive, unattractive bodies over and over again. Don't be obsessed with your physical appearance. Then, the next problem is that so many people think that this life is my problems are overwhelming, too much, it's all gone wrong, and the thought of suicide comes, an actual suicide comes. But that's a mistaken belief, that to kill this life will kill my problems. We have no choice. We have to be reborn again and again and again, no matter how much we think that there is true peace in the future. In the Lum Room, it says that the molten metal we've been forced to drink in the hells, the filth we've eaten as dogs and pigs, the tears we've shed, the separations we've experienced from friends, the times we've been killed, all of the filth we've eaten as maggots, these are all immeasurable. The only way out of this wilderness of samsara is to become disenchanted, to let go the illusory pleasures of mundane existence and turn our mind towards liberation and enlightenment with courage and with determination. We have to really be convinced of the reality of samsara. There was another sad situation in Australia just the week before I left, where a drunken driver lost control of his car, which mounted on the footpath, and killed three children from the same family. The oldest was a boy, about 12 or 13, and then his two younger sisters and their cousin, four, were killed by this car. This beautiful family, beautiful children, all going down to the shop to buy ice creams. And suddenly that, you know, normal, happy, friendly family situation, devastated. And the mother, she was shown on television, you know, going to this place where her children were killed. Incredibly distraught. She must have been a Christian. She didn't actually say it. But she said, "I can't be angry at this driver. It's not right to hate this drunken person who lost control and killed my children." An incredibly beautiful response. So difficult. But also she said, "My children have gone to a better place, gone to heaven." Hopefully, that's true. But from the Buddhist point of view, it's not necessarily true. You know, we do, there are a lot of superficial ideas that think, well, when I die, I'll go to heaven. Things will be better. And maybe this could be behind the mind of suicide, that this life is awful. It will be better afterwards. It might be, but there's no guarantee. No guarantee. You know, Buddha's teachings that each individual, their future life will depend upon their karma, the way they lived, the way they die. And so, it may give strength for this woman, the incredible strength of mind, to not have anger or hatred towards the person who killed her young children. But the reality, we're not necessarily like that. So think about it. The next general problem of samsara is that collections disperse. Whatever is built up, whatever we work so hard to develop, our status, collections, circle of friends, they have to disperse. They cannot stay together. All our life gathering things goes. When I did a 3-year retreat in Australia, I had absolutely no contact with the external world, apart from fresh goods for cooking, but there was no news. For 3 years, imagine, didn't see anybody, just focused on the meditation. But one time, some fresh vegetables were delivered, which I'd ordered, and they were wrapped up in newspaper. So, I thought, well, look, I should not distract my mind by reading news, but unwrapping the vegetables. And, well, I'll just see what. But this was from the section of the newspaper which was the classified advertisements. You know, I don't know what newspapers have here, but there's the news part, then there's all the advertisements. And this was just the advertisements. So I thought, well, I can read that. And it was very interesting because in the things for sale, there was an auction was being advertised of somebody who had died, and this person had been a phenomenal collector of ceramics, of silverware, of antique furniture. This obviously had been an extremely wealthy person. And so the list and photographs of their vast collection was described and illustrated for sale. And so I really thought about how much time, energy and money had this person put into gathering this enormous collection of valuable things, and now they're gone and it's being dispersed. Each piece is being auctioned individually and will go all around to other people who will start their collections. You know, they'll add the pieces to their collections. But what was the point of the person who lived and died? Probably died with so much clinging and attachment. I don't know if it was a male or female, to his or her collection. Gone. Dispersed. And each person who bought something to add to their collection, same thing will happen. They will die. Their collection will be dispersed. The high become low. We've seen people rise to high positions, become kings, queens, presidents, and then they lose their status. Dare I say, unfortunately, certain current presidents didn't lose their status recently. Well, the world might have been a better place, but it happens. Whether we are impeached, or whether we lose the next election, or whether we die, whatever, whoever rises in society inevitably must go down, collections are dispersed. Even birth, we celebrate a newborn baby. help, you know, and we're all happy. We hear about new healthy babies being born, and we all smile and we congratulate the parents, we want to see the new baby, give presents. But that birth is the cause of death. And so there will be a time, not too far in the future, when we'll all go to the funeral of that person who's just been born. And we'll all be very sad. Why does death happen? Because of birth is the primary cause of death. So again, between birth and death, what should we be doing? We should be training our mind in the path to liberation and to enlightenment. That, whatever degree of training we achieve, is not lost. It is a collection of realizations, is not dispersed at death, because it's in the mind, and the mind survives death. And so we take a collection of Dharma wisdom and Dharma attainment, whatever we've achieved, that goes with the mind into the next life. It is not lost. And it gives a tremendous advantage to whoever inherits our mind, right? We die, the person of this life, end of life, that's it. But the qualities of our mind, good or bad, will be inherited by somebody else. Well, we'll create a new life, which will have a different name. It won't be our present name. Although, one time, I was at Laodo, which is high up in the Himalayas, in the cave where Lama Zopa Rinpoche lived in his previous life as the Laodo Lama. You know, he was a layman and he used to do so much good for the Sherpa people. And so I was in the cave and Lama Zopa was telling me about the objects from the past life. And there was a little packet of gold leaf. And I thought, oh, Rinpoche, you can take your wealth into the next life. The gold of the past life. The present life has got the gold. Sort of joking, you know. Okay. So this loss of status is inevitable. Whatever we work for to achieve materially, socially, has to end, has to be lost. The final problem is always being alone. We're born alone. I mean, we all smile when we hear the cries of a newborn baby. But hey, that baby is crying because he's suffering. It didn't know what was happening. And for hour after hour, its head was squashed and it was forced through a passage which was too small. Even though the bones were all distorted of the skull. And there was a sense of suffocation. An incredible fear for the baby. What is going on? And then they're born and the light is so painful. You know, the baby screws up its eyes because the light is hurting. And if we go out of a dark room into a very lot of light, the light hurts. And if we get out of a, I don't know whether you have hot baths in Singapore, I mean, I only have cold showers, but if you do happen to lie in a hot bath in Australia, where it's colder, enjoying it, but when you get out of the bath, it's really cold, it's super cold. So the baby's been in the warmth of a womb for 9 months, and it's cold, so every newborn baby, not only are they crying, but they're shivering, because it's really, really cold. And it said that even the touch of cloth feels like sandpaper on a raw wound. Okay, so the baby has to experience this alone. It is comforted by mother. Already newborn babies can recognize their mother's voice because they heard it when they're in the womb. It's scientifically, it's true. Babies know their mother, and that gives some comfort. So mother is the primary source of comfort for a baby. But even during life, actually we're more alone. Mum and dad, yep, they're useful, but they're not really, they don't understand me. And we have our own fears, our own private problems. And we look for friends. Friends are useful, but we're really alone. Even a relationship, our spouse, our partner, is helpful, but not totally helpful. They don't really understand. And so we actually live life with a sense of loneliness, always seeking affirmation, friendship, but we're alone. And then, of course, when we die, we have to leave everybody behind and we go into the unknown of death, alone. So we're always alone. We're born alone, we live alone, and we die alone. Our friends cannot alleviate our inner suffering, our inner sorrow, and they can't accompany us into the next life. The only friend, you know, a friend is somebody who makes us happy, who gives us peace and happiness. The only friend that we can rely upon is our accumulation of virtue, you know, positive energy. From genuine, benevolent actions that we do to help others in life. That gives us peace and happiness. And that is in our mind. And when we, whatever situation in life, during life or when we're dying in particular, our accumulation of virtue, that gives self-confidence. That gives self-esteem. That gives courage and determination. If we have achieved things at the expense of others, that eats away at our self-confidence. Externally, society recognizes us, praises us, gives us knighthoods or whatever, medals. But if internally we are aware that we achieve this social recognition at the expense of others, where we've deliberately undercut others, there is this inner lack of confidence, there's this inner knowledge that I'm not as good as they think I am. Well, maybe there are some presidents who think they're better than people. But anyway, the point is, virtue, yes, virtue is real inner security. And that is the friend that's worthwhile. So, for all of these 6 points, the only sensible thing to do in life is to train our mind in loving kindness and compassion, generosity, friendship towards others, and to eliminate self-centeredness, greed, dissatisfaction, anger, hostility, pride. And that is the way to live our life and the way to die. All right, so those are the 6 general faults of existence. No matter whether we're humans or animals or divine beings in the Deva realms, they all have the same problem, the same problems. So these 6 faults, they really cover all the problems of samsara. But after lunch, we're going to talk in more detail about the specific sufferings of being a human. It's going to be rammed into our heads to make sure we understand. So, time for a break for lunch, and we'll continue after lunch. Thank you.